Welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. David Bray, an old friend from the US who has a very distinguished background. But his story is he basically started working for the government, as he tells me, when he was about 15, went got a business PhD, ended up in Afghanistan, ended up as a CIO in government, and then did amazing stuff with all sorts of people, including Vint Cerf. So, welcome, David.
Great to be here with you, Kate. And yes, I fell on my head at an early age and it made all the difference.
Tell me a bit about your journey, though, because I think it's really interesting.
Sure. I mean, and there's the phrase that, life only makes sense in reverse. I would say I became my parents. My mom was a school teacher. My father was a Methodist minister. My mom was Catholic before she agreed to marry my father, so she had to leave her faith, and I saw what that meant. And his skill sets were actually healing fragmented congregations and capital planning. So I realized I became both of them, just in a different setting at the intersection of society, data, and tech. And it really is trying to heal where there's different coalitions, different groups that all think there should be different directions you go with data and tech. Sometimes I succeed in building coalitions and actually succeeding in doing large projects. Other times, all the coalitions want you to be exclusively on their side, and that's a really difficult position. But government found me because I was good with computers, and so I had to get a work permit. Later was working in a classified capacity at age 17 with the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, and some of the work that was going on there. Worked for Microsoft and Yahoo, came back and dealt with the response to 9/11 and the anthrax events in the United States in 2001. Later, the original coronavirus. Got a PhD focusing on when do more people in tech make better decisions and when do more people in tech make worse decisions, because that also happens. And then did what everyone does after you do postdocs at MIT and Harvard, went to Afghanistan, raised my hand about 45 days in and said, why are we still here? Gave briefings, but of course, that was 2009, 2010, and I'm not sure everyone was really to listen to that at the time. Became a senior National Intelligence Service executive along the way. Got the opportunity to be the one nonpartisan with six Republicans, six Democrats in the United States reviewing all the research and development programs of the U.S. intelligence community. Parachuted into a role at the Federal Communications Commission where they'd had nine CEOs in 8 years. Always a great sign for CEO number 10 that things are
Oh,
just
that's
great.
always a terrific job.
Exactly. And on top of it, they had had two advanced persistent threats prior to my arrival. So I couldn't even trust the IT systems I was inheriting. And so we eventually moved everything to either public cloud or private hosting, which was partly to remedy some of the APTs, saved the taxpayers millions of dollars, went to go work with Vint Cerf, with the People-Centered Internet Coalition, experienced a disinformation attack around that time. Short version is, it turned out after the fact that both small groups of both political parties here in the United States had manufactured public comments and they were spamming the system. The challenge is that's permissible. But when I called it out and said that it looks like there is an application layer, effectively an application layer denial of service, they said, well, that's not network layer denial of service. I said, never said it was. And he said, where's your evidence? I said, well, less than 1% of US government agencies receive more than 10,000 comments for public commenting in 120 days. We're seeing 7,000, 8,000 comments at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., 6 a.m. US Eastern Time per minute. That doesn't take too much. And they're like, well, that's not forensics. I was like, I didn't think I needed forensics. They said, why didn't you report it to law enforcement? I was like, because technically it's not a violation of law, it's just spamming the system. Anyway, 4 years later, it turned out that what I said was right. You just soldier on. But along the way, got asked to do another commission. So I'm one of those people that's both shot at by both parties, but also occasionally brought in to do stuff. They wanted, again, this was now 8 and 8 from both sides of the political aisle, but also our friends and allies, including Australia, but also UK, Canada, Germany, India, and Japan, what we should do in terms of cybersecurity, supply chains, AI and trust in society, bio as well as space. And despite the fun, in quotation marks, of doing anything that was bipartisan, we actually succeeded in doing so in 2020 and 2021. The report was hand delivered to both the Congress and the administration. And as far as I know, because again, things are happening, none of our about 50% of our recommendations have been implemented and have not been repealed.
Oh, that's great. So it's an interesting area the confluence between data and cybersecurity. And I'm really quite interested in it because, if you can't trust the data, then you can't trust anything. Data is the foundation for everything. And now with AI, there's some pretty novel attacks that state actors can do. So let's talk a bit about that.
Sure. So actually just today I was talking with some colleagues in the AI and healthcare space. There is research that if you change 0.001% of the tokens associated with a generative AI system, you get really bad outputs when it comes to medical results. And that's 0.0, so that's a very slight, small data poisoning results in massive outcomes. So you're absolutely spot on that generative AI is highly dependent on the training data set. I would not recommend placing a lot of faith in DeepSeek. And in fact, if folks are interested, there's a lot of evidence that it is less than accurate if you ask it about certain news events. And yes, you can maybe remove the filter that says Tiananmen Square never happened, but there's still some things that make you just go, but again, that points to
Every AI's got its things that it won't talk about. Microsoft won't talk about certain things about its past, I think the main thing you need to do is understand the provenance, like who wrote it and where's it coming from, and use it for things that, we know what happened with Tiananmen Square. We don't really need to ask DeepSeek. I used it to reformat all my references from Chicago style to APA 7 the other
There
day.
you go. And I
Very
assume it didn't remove any, because it didn't find any objectionable or anything like that.
No.
Well, but it also points to, I mean, you probably remember. Do you remember Napster? I think right now generative AI is having a Napster-like moment where it's like, pay no attention to how we got this. Pay no attention to the fact that we're not respecting any real intellectual property or equity of the people that might have produced this data. Just enjoy the product. And so I'm waiting for a better approach that does do both provenance of the data, but also possibly respects the equity of it. Just a thought.
Yeah, that's a good thought. I wish more people had that thought. So the interesting thing for me about DeepSeek was how OpenAI were whining, "Oh, they stole our stuff," and everyone was like, "Oh, well, you stole ours. We don't care."
It's like,
They stole us
oh.
file in.
And that's where I'm hoping, whether OpenAI realizes they've got to do a different approach, or maybe someone who's not right now a leader in AI. So back in 2017, the UK put out its AI strategy. Lord Tim Clement-Jones, I want to give him a shout out. He actually was chairing it, and he and I met and we worked together. They called out the need in the UK for what's called data trust. You and I might call them data cooperatives or data collaboratives. It's the idea that using contract law, you can have people come together and say, we agree to have our data be used for these following purposes, to include being used for AI. And the nice thing is, you don't need any government regulation. It's just existing contract law that says, we as a group have come together and we're going to negotiate the terms and conditions. So I'm actually volunteering right now with an effort here in the United States for caregivers of infants from when they're born to age 3 and ideally longer. How do you make sure they get the necessary physical, mental, and emotional care? We're working on a chatbot to help them, because some of them, their number one source for information is TikTok. What could go wrong? But I raise that because maybe we need to do more pilots, and we don't have to wait for government to do anything, that actually treat data as a data trust, data collaborative, data cooperative.
Yeah, that kind of thing is a great idea. And it's using existing law. So, because law moves so slowly, if we wait for them to catch up, we'll have moved on by then anyway. And I don't
And
think we
quite
need
frankly, in the
law.
United States at the moment, government regulation is not in fashion at the moment for some mysterious reason.
Well, and I know there's an initiative, I was just Googling it, that artists can now use this data poisoning tool to fight back against AI scrapers, which is a reasonable response to the threat that they're under, but it doesn't help anybody. But I think the argument that the AI companies are making, that we've already stolen it, you just have to live with it, is not very good.
No, and I would to follow that through. If you look, so the Edelman Trust Barometer came out for 2025. They've just released it about 2 weeks ago. Trust is down across the board, but if you look at it, one of the things people report is they feel like they have lost agency choice and agency in how information is both delivered to them, but also how information about them is used. And so whether that's coming, and you look at the people who they are lacking trust in, it's in Western societies, it seems to be lack of trust in governments. In Western society, it seems to be lack in trust of social media companies. Shock. But also seems to be, increasingly across the board that there's actually some fervor going towards AI companies as well that have done the Napster-like moves. And so I would say, as a customer retention strategy, folks have got to change. But it's going to require a company that's going to be bold enough to be willing to show a better model. And maybe it's going to be one of the non-incumbents at the moment that see this as a market differentiator to do that.
Well, I'm fascinated by Microsoft. I love Microsoft. I have to do a lot of work with them, but there you're having Copilot, whether you want it or not, model is not winning them friends. Like it, you can opt out of it, but it's so hard to find. It's just the classic anti-pattern, and then just like you need to have Copilot even if you do not want it. It's just a ridiculous model, and it's making a lot of people quite unhappy with them.
Oh yeah, I mean, I had to. I mean, having been a CIO, I actually had to use had to edit the registry to intentionally block it from ever being loaded back onto my system. But not everybody can do that. Which does get to another question, which is, how can we incentivize companies like Microsoft and the like to change their business model? Because I think if anything, what we see right now with the AI companies, they're doubling down on the software as a service model. They're just doing AI as a service now. And I think that's because they think they can get massive valuations. Some of them can get IPOs and the like. And I think if we look at DeepSeek, DeepSeek was almost like the dart that punctured that balloon, saying maybe the future of AI is not massive valuations with AI as a service as this mega platform, but instead it's running locally and maybe it's open source, which means maybe you need a model that, dare I say, is consulting services around the AI, which is a different multiple than SaaS, but maybe that's the future.
Yeah, and I think what they did at the back end of doing some clever ways of processing was really good and really worth looking into. And I've long said that we're all going to have LLMs on our phone that know us really well, and they'll be personal to us, and they won't leave our phones, for example.
Right.
And that's the kind of future that most people want, a useful LLM that actually knows us, not Copilot offering to help me rewrite everything that I'm writing because I know how to write.
But I think that does point to, because I was at an event, I was invited to speak at an event 2 weeks ago, on the geopolitics of AI. Right now, the large tech companies in the West had been sort of building a competitive moat, access to high-end GPUs that nobody else could afford, and in a quantity that no one else could afford. Access, the idea that you needed to turn on nuclear power plants to power these things, that was the competitive moat they were building, which actually, in some respects, disadvantaged startups in Western societies from ever entering, because one, they couldn't get the data, and two, who has access to a nuclear power plant as a startup. But what's interesting is the model that you're talking about, exactly that is that one, I think that's what consumers want. Two, I think that's what's necessary if we actually want to have choice and agency and not become autocracies in thought or in reality. And three, how are we going to preserve privacy otherwise? Now, I know some people say privacy is dead. I am not one of them. And I think, this is the only way that free societies remain free 10 years from now is if we give more agency and choice both in our data, but also when and where we run AI. The question is, how do we incentivize investors and VCs to reward those companies that do that versus an alternative path?
Well, they're just jumping on the latest bandwagon. That's what they do. We only ever make progress from the people on the outside, typically
Yeah,
not the
well, that's why you and I
latest
do what we
company, the
do.
latest fad.
Yeah. But I do think, and it's worth knowing that what we're seeing right now with generative AI is actually a result of, so Tony Tether was a director at DARPA for a long time. He was big into the future being machine learning. And so investments that DARPA did more than 20 years ago in making it so that you could write transformer models without being a really advanced mathematician is what then paid off 20 years later in everything we saw.
Well,
And
a
so
lot of
we
what we've got comes from DARPA.
100%. Your phone. I mean, your phone, for example. I mean, yes, or GPS, or getting satellite imagery commercially available. And so the question is, what are the investments we need to do today if we want to have things that are privacy preserving, freedom preserving, et cetera, 10 years from now? Because if we don't place those bets now, and one of the people I will give a shout out if folks aren't familiar with, take a look at the work of Carl Friston. He's a neuroscientist, but he's arguing that active inference and inference-based methods are going to replace what we're doing with generative non-deterministic AI.
Well, I was just having a conversation with someone yesterday from the FAIR Institute, which is about valuing cyber risk inside your organization. We were talking about how generative AI is not really helpful for organizations because they need deterministic models so they can be reliable and consistent. And we're trying to do it by shoehorning agentic AI in to serve that purpose. But it's still not really working, and we're trying to then put RAG models with it, so it's problematic. So that's the thing, is if we can have that truly properly deterministic, but still generative like. But I really see generative becoming the front end of everything. So we talk to generative AI because it understands us when we just talk like we are now. But at the back end, it has some generative, some agentic bits, but also some deterministic bits. Because when I want a factual answer, I want a factual answer.
Right. Yeah. Well, I agree 100%. And it's worth knowing again, there's been so many flavors of AI, like expert systems are there, decision support systems are there, rule-based, computer vision. Computer vision is great and it's not non-deterministic. So I agree with you. I think generative AI has proven to be really good if it's about a conversation through text or speech. It's also really good, and this is where I caution people in cybersecurity. Generative AI is only as good if the present and future is embodied in the past training set. Well, if I'm a cyber attacker, the way I will attack you is I will do something completely different that I think is not in your training data set, so your AI system never picks me up at all. Now, that does present the opportunity for generative AI to establish what should be the normal patterns of life in your organization. Going back to my example of where I got, the fund that I had in 2017, I was able to spot that out and say, that's not a normal pattern of life. Now, whether that being, I didn't know at the time it was being done by political actors, I just said, that's not normal. And so I think that's where it gets useful in that you can say, what's the normal patterns of life for my environment? And then if something's outside the range of norm, is it a hardware failure, software failure, or an exploit? But that also runs the risk that what the attackers will do is then they'll just try to blend into what the normal is if they can do enough reconnaissance.
And I think this is where you got to differentiate between the script kiddies who are attacking and the state actors. The state actors get in and get in deep and watch for a long time, and the script kiddies are just like drive by.
Yeah, they're just opportunistic and everything like that. Well, and that gets a deeper question, which is, well, so two things is one, I know we're here about data and AI, but I'm going to share about 2 years ago, the US Department of Defense had a competition to see if any company could to do what's called deep hardware interrogation. At the chipset level, is the hardware really what it claims to be and nothing else? And there were 37 companies, a company won. If folks are interested, I'll share the link with you if you want to put it, but I don't necessarily want to, I'm not the type that gives visible endorsements. I'm just saying this company won. And as a result, they were asked to take a look at two routers from a US equipment manufacturer that had been in use for the last 10 years in an underwater nuclear environment. Leave your imagination and let you guess. Anyway, they ran it. They said, we're getting a weird result. Can we open up the box? They opened up the box. 4 hours later, they found two small Huawei daughter boards soldered onto that router. That was 2 years ago. I raise that because if what we're in a world in which, and it was clear it was not a one-off, like what was doing is the Huawei daughter board when the router booted up was loading into memory, instructions to phone home. I would submit we're now in a world in which we haven't verified the hardware. And I think we'd be surprised at how compromised it really is.
Well, one organization I used to work for, we used to buy American routers, and we used to get them. We used to buy the ones that were manufactured in Japan, and they used to be shipped directly here. The rest of them got routed through a US. I wonder why. And there were reasons.
Yeah.
should we say.
Yeah. Should we say? And I just
Everyone's
raised.
doing it. Everyone's doing it.
Well,
But
and even worse, even weird, or even worse, the ones the ex there is now examples of those routers being compromised in our own country in the United States. So the actors are actually able to, through either access through the OEM or the shipper or something like that, compromising it in country. And so when I brief people on cybersecurity, I'm like, there is a gray zone conflict going on just below the threshold of being a warlike event. But that does mean cybersecurity is one of the ways. There's other ways. Disinformation attacks on companies, that's another way. Sadly, I'm also seeing blackmail of private sector C-suite officers or board members,
oh, yeah.
getting them in a compromising position and saying, as long as you do what you were told, everything's okay. And I'm like, sure. So yeah, this is a challenge.
I think you've raised a really good point, though, that is a kind of a data related point, which is our supply chains. So there's our physical supply chains for hardware, there's our data supply chains, because if we're going to be using automated decision making in future, we need to make sure our data pipelines are pure and haven't been corrupted. So one of the things, especially in a medical context, I really care about the immutability of the data. Like if I've got a pacemaker, I don't want that to get hacked.
Right. Well, and the challenge is, and that's where I think for the pacemaker, what you hope is, I'm not a fan of formal method solves everything, but the amount of processing you need to do on the pacemaker is small enough that formal methods can be a way that you can actually do all the possible Turing states for the machine, and you make sure you've mapped it out, and it can't be exploited. But that doesn't solve everything. Like formal, people who say we're going to use formal methods for your web browser, I'm like, yeah,
Yeah,
that's nice.
I'll do
It's not
that.
going to work. The moment I install a plugin, it's going to break. But anyway, so.
So really, because we've seen some really bad supply chain hacks. Remember SolarWinds, which was
Yes.
really egregious, and people it woke people up to the fact that their software supply chains need to be managed. And you can't assume that even a trusted vendor is giving you good software.
Right. Or that software that you cleared once remains clear going forward. In this case, the moment an update came. I mean, also look at XZ Utils. Open source software is a battleground. Surprise. And so circling back to AI and building on what you're saying, some of the best tools for optical character recognition on GitHub are actually backed by PRC contributors. What could possibly go wrong? And again, I don't want to, I mean, I'm a globalist at heart as well, but I need to recognize that nation states are playing nation state games, and they're doing it for various reasons. And I think this is where, for free societies where we have the luxury of choice, because we do have the freedom of choice, we've got to figure out how do we up our game. Given that actually the very freedoms and the very openness that we celebrate also makes us targets.
Yeah. And so this leads in, because people don't realize that data and technology are utilities to us as humans, but are nation state weapons, and above our pay grades for most of us, there's literally a war going on, and some quite substantial attacks. Like pe normal people have routers that have been hacked and are being used
Because the routers don't get
by
updated.
botnet
Password.
armies as part of this war that different states are fighting.
Yeah, and yes, and exactly, and it's also the idea that if they can pour kerosene on a wedge issue in a free society, I mean, the nice thing about free societies is you can disagree, but if they can throw accelerants on it and make the wedge issue seem even more extreme, or if you take out the connectors, those that are trying to build bridges like you and I, so yeah. We'll wave to the camera right now, as our biometrics are giving up online. So I think, yeah, I think it remains to be seen how a coalition of free societies, because I do think it's going to take a coalition, will respond, given that it is such a, in some respects, it goes to free speech, it goes to individual agency, it goes to capital markets. And the last thing I would say real quick is none of the generative AI companies, the big generative AI companies from the West at the moment, have made a profit off of generative AI alone. They may have made it off of cloud and everything else.
Fascinated by OpenAI's balance sheet. They are spending money to make money. They took $9 billion of investment recently and they spent it all before they got it.
Oh, and I don't know if you saw it. And in fact, this is just of today. Google has announced that they're committing $75 billion just for 2025.
They're
And
big
like,
dollars. And the interesting thing is when you look at China, they've actually done some really interesting stuff. And looking at their Qwen models and things, they've been doing a lot of research too. So everybody, there's sort of an AI arms race happening right now.
and I think what I would hope is, so a year ago in January 2024, I was asked to host five dinners on whether or not there was appetite from the investment community for better, more energy efficient, less data intensive approaches to AI, including active inference. Like Carl Friston was someone I got to host a conversation with. January 2024, nope. Investors just wanted to double down on, more cowbell, more generative AI as is. And I'm like, oh. I'm wondering if now the real politique may make some investors more interested. And or again, I would say right now, generative AI is really hard to enter into as a startup because where are you going to get the data? Where are you going to get the CPUs? And so maybe, and there are companies, I will name a Canadian company, so it doesn't look like I'm endorsing just US ones. There's Versus in Canada, there's Houso in the United States that are doing better approaches to AI that are not doubling down on deep learning. The question is, will investors be willing to put money towards that? Because I think their future is not one platform to rule it all. But the reality is, do any of us really want one AI platform to rule it all? Or like you said, do we want to run it locally? So.
Well, the interesting thing for me is how do we, like, if you've got a generative AI startup, you're mad because, like, they're a dime a dozen, everybody, but you don't own your underlying assets. And the real problem, it seems to me, is there the amount of data in the world that is needed to train all these models is already exhausted. So we've got the real problem of with these big models that are huge, bigger and bigger, need more and more training data. I think the future will be small LLMs with small data sets that you can run. And I keep telling people, look to building your own capability to run and build your own LLMs. They're open source, you can get them, they're pretty easy to understand. But look at doing small stuff with your own training data so that you own it instead of giving your data away to somebody else because your data is valuable.
100%. And if anything, so for the last, I guess it's been since about 2021, I've been trying to brief people and say data is not the new oil. Oil, use it up, it's gone. Data, use it, it's still there. But also on top of it, if you involve the stakeholders associated with the data, it actually gets better. They refine it, they find errors, they fix it, they actually create more data. And what I would ultimately say is I think we need a paradigm that says data is a form of human voice. It's what you want, what you don't want, whether it's a policy action, whether it's a preferential action. In the United States, here in the United States, when we initially had COVID, the federal government rolled out funding to the states to put testing centers for COVID. And the states did what they thought was logical, which is they put it where people lived. Well, if you actually looked at the data, and this happened to be data that was from private companies, including a big tech company, for certain parts of the country, including if you were Black or Hispanic, where you worked was about 45 minutes away from where you lived. And so, if they put a testing facility where you lived and it was open during normal work hours on weekdays, well, that you can't actually easily get access to it. And so, you had newspapers saying there's hesitancy on the part of these groups to actually get tested for COVID. It's like, no. You just put the testing sites in the wrong place. And the moment those states fixed things and put it where people worked as opposed to where they lived, they saw no hesitancy whatsoever. And so I think, especially in free society, we may need to update our approaches to say data is a form of human voice. Let's give you
Also,
some.
to use data for decision making, like it sounds like they had the data, and just a moment to think about it. People who leave early to go 45 minutes away, they're not really there during business hours.
No. Well, and so again, and I'll go back to my birth to three effort. So, you know, it's troubling when you realize that a lot of single parent caregivers are going to TikTok, because I'm like, for how to raise a child. But when we actually peeked underneath the hood as to could we find enough information to train a chatbot with a nonprofit, because we didn't want to monetize their data ever. I mean, this is a vulnerable population. What we found was the information landscape was so fragmented at the state level and at the county level, and some of these things were changing every 3 or 4 months, that as even a human, it is difficult for me to find the right guidance for services and benefits and information on how to raise a kid as a human. And that points to a larger problem, which is at least in the United States, we may need to defragment our information landscape so it's useful and usable, not just by humans, but ultimately by chatbots that are trained for you, as opposed to some mega company.
I even found that at a university. Students come to the student center, and there are multiple student centers. So there's the university level, the faculty level, the school level, and they answer shop because they go to one group, they don't get the answer they want, so they go around and talk. And if you're trying to build chatbots, pre-generative AI was super hard to build good ones. And our information landscape was so fragmented that finding the right answer from all of the myriad of documents that were out there was actually really hard. And a RAG
Right.
wouldn't help you because you had to use a human to go, well, this document and this document actually contradict each other. We need to do some harmonization work, all of this to make sense so that we can then automate the responses. So it was a really funny conversation to have of like you guys haven't got your shit together.
Right. No tech is going to help you until you get your human stuff together. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you know, that is a lot of the conversations that I'm having now with people is all these people want to do AI and they haven't got their plumbing right. So they haven't got their data pipelines right. They haven't got their data governance right. And they're going, we want to do AI. And I'm like, how?
I know. It's a magic wand. What do you mean? You just wave the magic wand. All is good.
Literally what the CEOs are saying. It's magic.
Now, on a similar note, so obviously there's a lot of questions in the US about our export control policy when it comes to AI and AI tech capabilities. And given DeepSeek, when I saw DeepSeek happened, I have seen over the last 10 years whether the US did export controls over tech going to Iran because we didn't want them to get nuclear capabilities, or we did similar things to Russia or most recently China. I was like, I really wish we had a combination of human and AI teams whose jobs were to figure out how someone might figure out loopholes in export control policy before it's passed. And so I just had fun. I picked a GPT of choice. And when there was an export control policy passed by the previous administration and the tail end of that administration before they left, I said, give me 5 ways that you would work around this recently passed US export control. The GPT gave me 5 ways to do it. And I'm like, yeah.
And that was one of the things that hit me when ChatGPT first came out of like, oh my, and I was downloading with a friend some open source models like Mistral. And I was like, oh my God, this means bad guys can have the same power that we've got on their devices. Like they can take a copy, no one knows they've got it. So the bad actors have all the power of an LLM in their hands, and they can ask it questions like that, and you don't even know they're doing it.
Right. Oh, it's and then on top of it, again, what are generative AI really good at? As you know, I mean, they're really good at creating realistic looking human content that's not from human at all, whether it's text, audio, video, and the like. And so we've produced almost the perfect fraudster scammer tools, and we haven't upgraded our society to deal with the fact that, I mean, at least in the United States, we've seen ransomwares, you know, it more than doubles each year in terms of global damages, but also in terms of scams are believed to be 50 times as worse, if not more, in terms of money extorted relative to fraud and ransomware. And so I think it's just going to be really bad.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we're telling people in Australia is for their families to have a code word. So
100%. Yeah, same here. Yes,
have
exactly.
a separate code word that you don't tell anybody, and ask the scammer if they know the code word, and if they don't give them money.
It's a deep fake, exactly. It may sound like a relative or a family member, but it's not. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. But what let's talk about the I want to just take a moment to talk about the world landscape, because you've talked about a free society and obviously value civil society. With the world seemingly with a lot of governments now tending towards as more slightly authoritarian, some might even say fascist bent, what tools can we use to help us maintain a free society
Right.
or an idea of a free society?
So I think the first step is to step back and look at a sense of history. And I've been trying to remind people of this I get it. At least in the United States, there may be some people that are fans of the current administration. There may be other people who are not fans of the current administration and everything like that. I go back to the Federalist Papers that set up the United States, in which they said, "What is government but the greatest reflection of humanity? If all men and women were angels, no government would be necessary." So they recognize that, the whole point of the system is to have checks and balances. And they said they wanted ambition to counter ambition. So it is worth remembering that our second and third presidents, at the time when he was elected president, second president was John Adams, his vice president was Thomas Jefferson, both of which who have monuments and statues to their honor. Thomas Jefferson, as a vice president to John Adams, hired a political hitman to spread disinformation about John Adams wanting to go to war with France when that was not true. And John Adams, as a sitting president, was writing op-eds saying his vice president, Thomas Jefferson, literally was the devil. That, ladies and gentlemen, was the 1800s.
Old stuff, if you know any history, that disinformation and misinformation have been around for a long time. But
Exactly.
I think the difference now is it can spread exponentially at scale around the world. Whereas before, the handful of people that read that article that the president read. So
Well, and not everyone even had access to reading and everything like that. I agree. And what I tell people is through the internet, through your smartphone, now through generative AI, you have the capabilities the CIA and the KGB had circa the late 1970s. Yay. And there's amazing things you can do. You can call anyone at a moment's notice. We can have this conversation. If you ideally you get someone's permission, but you can geolocate. You can download commercial apps and get satellite footage as recent as 15 minutes ago at 0.25 meter resolution. That's incredible. However, yes. And so I think there's a whole lot of anxiety out there at the moment, to be candid, about the future. And I'm trying to figure out ways for people to step back and channel that anxiety to actually taking whatever steps they feel they can do in their own lives, because that overcomes a sense of learned helplessness and helps you overcome the anxiety. I mean, I for one, I go running a lot, and that helps channel it. But I think I'm not saying be complacent, but recognize that our sentiments as to where the world is going may be colored by our own preferences. And I celebrate for one that we are still allowed to have those different preferences. And so I think in the United in the world, work at the local level. In some respects, it's always at the end of the day, it comes down to the local level. And figure out how I still, I mean, personally, I channel my energy to giving people stakeholderism or equity in data. I think a lot will flow from that. In the United States, and I realize we're a little bit different than other parts of the world, I'm a big believer in helping people figure out how we shift from fee-based service for healthcare to value-based healthcare, which actually you'll find there's a lot of people that are supporter of market-based mechanisms that want to do that too, because in some respects, fee-based healthcare motivates the wrong outcomes. So I guess for me, it's almost like if you we. While it rarely looks like history, we're in the midst of living in it. It remains unseen where this will go. And I think if you find opportunity to do what you can at the local level, that's in some respects all that, unless we are a politically elected official, which I'm not, that's at least what we can influence. So.
And I think that's good advice for everybody. Build local networks because that's where you live. Find an outlet, running for some people, walking for me.
Again, whatever works for people, exactly. Yes.
Well, this has been a really great chat. Thanks, David. It's been lovely to see you again. Sorry I didn't get over in October. I was in London for the launch of our blockchain startup.
I want to hear more later. Yes, please tell me more about your startup. And it's great to see you. Hopefully, we'll see you at CCE this October. And we'll give a shout out to Ray Wong too.
Yeah, he's always a marvel. Lovely
All
to
right.
talk. Thank you.
Thank you.